On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Brian Chi and Mr. Curtis Franklin here today. Now, a new report is showing that organizations just might be taking the security challenge seriously. The question is, do they know where to focus? Well, we'll definitely talk about that. Plus, we have a really great host roundtable. Now, the hybrid work environment is here to stay. People will continue to work from home. Plus, they'll use devices for both personal use and corporate use. To address some of those challenges, Secure Access Service Edge, or SASE, has emerged. All the hosts will get into it. They'll take you through the landscape, what it is, what advantages there are to it, and how to take advantage of it in your organization. Definitely shouldn't miss it. It's Wyatt on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 467, recorded October 29th, 2021, The Road to Zero Trust. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Compiler, original podcast from Red Hat discussing tech topics, big, small, and strange. Listen to Compiler on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you listen to your podcasts. And by Bandwidth. Bandwidth understands the challenges enterprises face when migrating their communications to the cloud. That's why Bandwidth launched Duet for Microsoft Teams, the only complete solution for direct routing and Microsoft-certified E911 available direct from a carrier designed to simplify your migration to Teams direct routing. Request your proof of concept at bandwidth.com/twit. And by Command Line Heroes, an original podcast from Red Hat that tells the epic true tales of developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels who are revolutionizing the technology landscape. Season 8 is out now. Search for Command Line Heroes on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you listen to your podcasts. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I am your host, Louis Maresca, your guide to this big world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's a senior analyst at Omdia. And like I said before, he has the pulse of the enterprise. Welcome to the show, Curtis. How are you doing?
I am just fine, Lou. It's been a busy week over here. Was part of a virtual event on SASE on Wednesday. I have more virtual events and webinars coming up, along with a bunch of research for reports and predictions. I am just a researching fool down here in the Sunshine State.
Fantastic. I'm looking forward to some of the outcomes there. Thanks for being here, Curtis. Well, we also have to welcome Mr. Brian Chi. He's the net architect at SkyFabre and the all-around tech geek. Chibert, how are you doing, my friend? How's this week going for you?
My precious.
Ooh, new toys.
Yes, beta hardware from Ubiquiti. This is their new Dream router. So that ought to be fun. But anyway, the plan is I'm going to actually physically separate my IoT tinkering from my production network at home, and we'll see how that goes.
See, you're doing what most people should be doing in a remote work sense. So it might be a good case study there.
Yeah, I'm one of these fine days. I need to go put up a managed layer 2 switch in the house so that I can start VLANing things off and try and stop making myself a target for somebody.
That's right. Fantastic. Well, thanks for being here, Chibert. We have a pretty packed show for you guys today, for everybody in our audience. You know, a new report is actually showing that organizations just might be taking the security challenge seriously, like Chibert is trying to do here. The question is, do they know where to focus? We'll talk about it. Plus, we have a great host roundtable again today. The hybrid work environment is here to stay. People will continue to have some days where they use devices both for personal and for corporate issued uses. To address the challenges there, Secure Access Service Edge, or SASE, has emerged. All the hosts will actually get into what that is and maybe even take you through the landscape there. But before we get into all that goodness, let's go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. Now, it wouldn't be a week in the enterprise without ransomware impacting it somewhere. Now, this week, the Hive ransomware gang is at it again, scaling their efforts to make organizations' lives miserable. Now, this week, they are also encrypting Linux and free BSD using new malware variants specifically developed to target these platforms. However, the only good thing is, as ESET discovered, is Hive's new encryptors are still in development, still lack functionality. So basically, they're in beta. Beta ransomware. That's a new thing. Now, the Linux variant also proved to be quite buggy during ESET's analysis, with the encryption completely failing when the malware was executed with an implicit or explicit path. It also comes with support for a single command line parameter called no wipe. Now, in contrast, Hive's Windows ransomware comes up with up to 5 execution or options, including killing processes, skipping disk, cleaning uninteresting files and older files. Now, the ransomware's Linux version also fails to trigger the encryption if executed without root privileges, because it attempts to drop the ransom note on compromised devices' root file systems. Now, the Hive, who has been active since at least June 2021, has already hit over 30 organizations, counting only victims who refused to pay the ransom. Now, they're just one of the many ransomware gangs that have begun targeting Linux servers after their enterprise targets have slowly migrated to virtual machines for easy device management and more efficient use of resources. Now, there is a large list of them, actually, who actually limit or implemented the Linux encryptors. That includes Go Google, DarkSide, Hello Kitty, and Black Matter. Now, what this means for organizations is that they need to start to focus a little bit of their energy on their Linux systems as they do on their Windows ones.
Well, there's a new way to get ransomware, and it involves search engine optimization. Attacks involving SEO poisoning, where adversaries artificially increase the search engine ranking of websites hosting their malware in order to lure potential victims, are on the rise. In the past few months, attackers have used the tactic in at least 2 campaigns across Menlo Security's global customer base, researchers there say. One was to distribute the Reval ransomware sample, and the other was to drop a backdoor called Solar Marker. The attacks highlight recent efforts by threat actors to target users instead of organizations in their malicious campaigns. The security vendor described the trend as likely being driven by adversaries seeking to take advantage of the current remote work environment, where the lines between personal and business device use have blurred. In search engine optimization poisoning attacks, adversaries first compromise legitimate websites and then inject specific keywords into the website that users might commonly search for via their preferred search engine. The goal in injecting the keywords is to ensure that the compromised website surfaces near or on top of search engine results when a user searches for something that uses the keywords. In the Solar Marker campaign that Menlo Security observed, users who clicked on the poisoned link were directed to a malicious PDF hosted on the compromised site and eventually ended up with the back door on their systems. Menlo Security said that all the compromised websites in the Solar Marker campaign were WordPress sites that contained a plugin called Formidable Forms. It's unclear, however, whether the plugin played any role in allowing the attackers to break into the sites. The attackers also employed a relatively simple evasion technique by using large size payloads to try and sneak SolarMarker past anti-malware tools. The largest payload we observed was 123 megabytes, researchers say. Unfortunately, tools tend to have a file size limit on what they can or cannot analyze.
So, first, it was toilet paper, then processors and silicon, not cardboard, and a lot of other stuff in between. While the latest kink in the planet's ever-gnarled supply chain is one that's sending retailers, shippers, and consumers all scrambling, cardboard supplies are unreliable, as are those for other packing materials like paper and plastic. What is available costs more, with loads of companies passing the increased expenses to customers. Many of the cardboard producing paper mills around the world shut down at different points during the COVID-19 pandemic. While plants have been coming back online, they're still scrambling to fill a backlog of orders. Meanwhile, consumer shopping habits altered by the pandemic are also a factor, with most of the world having experienced some sort of lockdown since the beginning of 2020. Homebound shoppers have turned to Amazon and other online outlets in increased numbers for life's necessities. Well, in another example of how the pandemic has changed our world, it looks like holiday shopping needs to happen sooner than later. As I unpack from the great move from Hawaii to Florida, instead of just tossing my boxes into a recycle bin, we're putting them up on Nextdoor so that my boxes can be directly recycled by my neighbors instead of needing to go through the labor-intensive cycle where my boxes are pulped and turned back into packing materials. Might I also suggest that if you're going to be doing a bunch of Amazon orders, consider choosing having them delivered on an Amazon day. That way, Amazon's packers will try and fit more into less cardboard. And maybe, just maybe, if we all do our part, the cardboard manufacturers might have a chance to catch up. What do you say?
Maybe, just maybe. Well, after last week's news of Apple debuting the M1 Pro and M Max and Intel announcing their foundry plans, it seemed like there was a positive outlook on supply chain issues. Not so much. They're still happening, especially in the chip market. And it's becoming clear that snarls in the semiconductor supply chain are weighing in on economic growth. Both GM and Ford said that missing chips led to slash profits for the third quarter. And Apple is actually rumored to be cutting this year's production targets for its iPhone lineup, the company's cash cow. Now, chip woes have become so widespread that a division of Wells Fargo thinks that the pressures will curtail U.S. GDP growth by 0.7%. As with many thorny problems, there are numerous causes of the chip shortage, and none of them are quick fixes. Recently, substrates that make up printed circuit boards have become scarce. Compared with advanced semiconductors, PCBs are relatively low margin and are easy to manufacture, but most chip companies don't make their own. But without PCBs, semiconductors can't talk to other chips in the computer. Now, the companies that do make the boards don't make a lot of profit that they can reinvest in expanding production. Even the world's richest semiconductor manufacturers are swamped, and they are a long way away from being able to meet demand. There are some bigger projects in the works to try to help it. In fact, Intel, Samsung, and TSMC have all announced new fabs in recent months, but those won't come online for years, in part because the facilities need a host of supportive infrastructure from power plants to fresh water supplies. As manufacturers add incrementally to existing facilities, we could see some shortages easing sooner than later. However, additions typically take 12 to 18 months to complete. Now, entirely new fabs, though, take 2 to 3 years. Could be even longer. Now, given today's long lead times, incremental capacity may not be enough. Now, what does this mean? It means that the market will continue to squeeze innovation and profits until this gets under control. Now, let's hope all the plans set out by manufacturers will actually succeed, and we'll be pleasantly surprised. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech. And that's Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat discussing tech topics big, small, and strange. Compiler comes to you from the makers of Command Line Heroes, another of our sponsors, and is hosted by Angela Andrews and Brent Simino. Technology can be big, bold, bizarre, and complicated. Compiler unravels industry topics, trends, and the things you've always wanted to know about tech through interviews with the people who know it best. On their show, you'll hear a chorus of perspectives from the diverse communities behind the code. Compiler brings together a curious team of Red Hatters to tackle big questions in tech, like what's technical debt or what are tech hiring managers actually looking for, and do you have to know how to code to get started in open source? Well, the first episode covers a topic of much debate in the tech world. Should managers code? Now, jumping in to fix the problem can be very seductive. Now, in this episode of Compiler, you'll hear from a manager who has learned that supporting his team to fix the problem rather than doing it himself might be slower, but it can lead to better results. Now, a managerial position is seen as a milestone of working life. Suddenly, a person who worked on code begins to step back from those day-to-day tasks. What does that mean? What started as an internal email at Red Hat blossomed to a much deeper discussion about the career growth and what can get caught in its wake. Have you ever walked into an interview and been asked to work through a coding problem or on a whiteboard? I definitely have. Now, if you were hired, how much time do you actually spend in front of a whiteboard on the job? In the how do you interview for a tech position, Red Hatters cast a skeptical eye toward the dreaded whiteboard interview, but discover that can actually have some real benefits. I've checked out the first episode, Should Managers Code? I found it very enlightening, actually. You know, as a manager in the tech industry, I can definitely tell you I've always had this feeling that managers should really understand the technology and be able to code. But the perspectives in this episode were really interesting, and I definitely feel both sides of the coin there. So definitely check out that episode. It's very interesting. Episodes are out now. Go and download them anytime, and be sure to check back for new shows. Listen to Compiler on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you listen to your podcast. We'll also include a link on this episode's show page. My thanks to Compiler for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, like I said before, a new report is actually showing organizations just might be taking that security challenge seriously. The question is, do they know where to focus? Do they know where to start? How seriously are they taking it? Curtis?
Thanks, Lou. Well, you know, in physical defense, when you look at militaries, there's a great saying that we're always preparing to fight the last war. And in many cases, that's true in cybersecurity as well. We're always putting all of our effort into preparing to stop the last breach, the last attack, the last successful intrusion. So how do we make sure that we're not constantly behind the ball? Well, that's something that a lot of CISOs have been thinking about, and we're starting to see some attention being paid to how to solve the problem. We've had some very high-profile attacks in the last 18 months, everything from Colonial Pipeline to the recent Kaseya and Sinclair television stations. And they are being successful at helping boards and executives be more supportive of spending more money ahead of a successful attack. Over at Dark Reading, they did a survey called the 2021 Strategic Security Survey, and that showed that companies are substantially increasing the size of their security organization and security budget. Now, that's good news. The bad news, that the leaders are still having some trouble figuring out where to invest for the most impact. Over in that survey, 70% of the respondents agreed or strongly agreed that the attacks on the Colonial Pipeline and the meatpacking company JBS significantly increased their organization's concern about ransomware. That's wonderful. But about the same percentage said that the cybersecurity staff is already stretched too thin, which can result in burnout, which can result in increasing the risk to data. So what do they really need to do? One of the big things that companies are doing is paying more attention to risk. You're seeing a lot of companies look at risk assessment, risk monitoring, and risk measurement as ways to try and get ahead of the curve when it comes to defending themselves against attacks. The idea being, if you know where your weaknesses are, you know where to spend money to shore them up. Now, this look at risk and the emphasis on risk is something that's being encouraged by organizations outside of the enterprises themselves. And most of those organizations come in one of two flavors. They're either regulatory auditing organizations, which look at how well you're complying with regulations, or, and this is even more important, they're insurance companies. The companies that have to set rates for cybersecurity insurance are trying to make sure that the companies they insure have lowered their risk as much as possible. And to do that, it requires getting ahead of where the attackers are. I want to ask my co-host about this because it really deals with a lot of different areas. Brian, I know that in your work, you looked at a lot of different risks. Did you have trouble convincing the people in management and executive positions that they should invest money before they were compromised?
You got to remember, part of my life was mostly with the military, and then part of my life was mostly research academia. Can we say radically different environments? So let's answer it two ways. The military side, getting people to pre-invest, as long as you can plan on it so that you're not asking for the money in the same fiscal year, you didn't have to convince the higher-ups too often or too hard to get them to migrate towards a more secure solution, because they knew they were fighting a losing battle anyway. Now, going to the latter half of my career, the academic researcher. Now, the academic researcher, you could ransomware their personal storage out from under them, destroy their research, and trash their reputation, and they'll still fight you on multi-factor authentication. I don't understand it. I just tried really, really hard after a unpatched or badly patched device was hacked out from under a research group that we really need to start thinking about, at least at the VPN level, to go multi-factor authentication, and they weren't playing. So it kind of depends on what environment you're in. Everybody says the military is paranoid. So getting people that are already paranoid to go and adopt new things and add to the security isn't that hard. Now, if you're in an open environment, the other side of the coin, in case of academia, I'm fighting a losing battle. So I guess you really need to stop and think about what kind of organization you are and where you are between those two polar opposites.
Yeah, that's an interesting question to come between the polar opposites. And Lou, I want to turn to you because you have spent more of your life in the corporate world. And when it comes to investing in security from the get-go, you know, from the earliest parts of designing applications and systems, you know, what kind of arguments do you find are being made in companies both for and against the notion that we should be more proactive when it comes to cybersecurity?
You know, I think that their arguments are obviously that specific IT organizations only get specific amount of budget to do things, and they're usually year over year budgets that are equal or if not less. And so when it comes to adding in new potential, if not pie in the sky, vulnerabilities, most organizations lean towards not spending the extra dough. They usually either cut something or they go and not do the extra mile to secure things. And I think, you know, it's really these organizations that are getting creative that are saying, okay, you know, let's go and do less work for our internal user and more work for our security of our organization, and pick the highest ROI items. Like, for instance, making sure our remote workforce is secure, encrypting things, making sure that we use the right authentication schemes and models, targeting zero trust, stuff like that. And I think that those are the highest ROI items. And so they know that they need to do it. They know that they want to do it. The question is, can they actually fund it? And I think that's where most organizations have that problem. When you hear organizations take months sometimes to deploy software updates, and you say, hey, listen, like, you're not on the latest. Why don't you target the latest thing? And they say, well, we can't target the latest thing. That's an extra 3 months. So I'll have to stick with 3 months old. That's a problem. That's a problem that they're not funding the right thing in order to meet the requirements that the organization needs to stay secure. And I think that's where they need to spend a lot of time and money and effort. And again, you have to be crafty in order to do that sometimes.
You know, you really do. And I think this is really where the idea of assessing risk comes in and is valuable, because it does help identify some of, as Lou has pointed out, the low-hanging fruit, where the ROI is optimized. Now, the good news is that we're seeing more and more frameworks, tools, and processes for assessing risk. And one of the critical parts of assessing risk is actually being able to turn it into dollar amounts, because once you do that, you really are talking the language of the boardroom. The bad news is that there so far is no consistent way to express the risk. I have looked at a number of different products over the past few months, each of which does a credible job at helping to establish and monitor risk. Each one has some sort of scorecard. You know, your risk is now 84 on a scale of 0 to 100, or it's 7.5 on a scale of 1 to 10. You know, pick your favorite metric. There is, however, no good way to compare ratings from one system to another. And that makes it difficult for companies to know whether their risk is in line with their industry, if they are in a position of higher risk, or if they're actually doing better than most of their industry. There are some groups out there trying to do standards, FAIR is the organization that most people refer to, and the FAIR framework is a very good place to go and look if you're interested in starting the process of risk assessment within your organization. But again, it's a framework. It's used by a lot of companies, but it's not the sort of lingua franca that the industry really, really needs if we're going to take the next step in using risk to make proactive decisions about cybersecurity. Now, this is one I promise we're going to talk about more, and I can say that because one of my areas of research for next year is on these systems for doing risk assessment and monitoring. And so it's going to be filling up the porous cavities in my poor overworked head for much of next year. I'll be happy to share that with you. But before we do any of that, speaking of sharing, Lou, I think you need to share with us some information about another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you, Kurt. We will get to our host roundtable in just a minute. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Bandwidth. Provide accurate 911 caller information for Microsoft Teams users and maintain compliance with complicated E911 regulations during your migration with Bandwidth Duet for Teams. Moving to Microsoft Teams can be complicated, but Bandwidth Duet for Microsoft Teams empowers you to simplify your move with software-driven SIP, dynamic E911 capabilities, and industry-leading expertise. Solve the E911 challenge for modern enterprises under the federal regulation named Ray Bombs Act. Enterprises are required to provide a dispatchable location, which includes the street address, as well as more granular information, such as a building, floor, or room number. The problem is that employees with soft phones are often moving freely between campuses, buildings, and remote offices to work and collaborate, so providing accurate location to the public safety is challenging. Now enter Duet for Microsoft Teams, where Bandwidth leverages an advanced dynamic E911 for Teams solution to identify the location of a Teams connected user at the time of the emergency call. Really cool. Now, Bandwidth natively routes the 911 call across their secure, highly reliable nationwide network and provides the caller's current location to help mitigate compliance concerns and, most importantly, help enhance employee safety. Now, simplify direct routing migrations. If your organization is considering direct routing, Bandwidth Duet for Microsoft Teams gives you greater control and value by helping you decouple your telephony from Teams. Now, you get the advantages of working directly with a cloud-native carrier, including failover control, call forwarding, and real-time reroutes on all on the Microsoft Teams platform. Now, with Bandwidth Duet for Teams, you save 40% compared to Microsoft calling plans. Now, rely on unlimited 933 testing capabilities so you can easily verify that your location information meets compliance standards without burdening public safety with live 911 calls. Now, you'll have a migration partner, not just a provider, and you'll get a dedicated onboarding specialist to help execute your project plan, a 24/7 knock, and expert support teams who will accelerate your migration and be with you every step of the way. Now, group your users into logical cohorts like location or department. This way, you can schedule and trigger ports for these individual groups, but also seamlessly roll back if you ever need to. Everyone says they've got great support, but Bandwidth proves it by just being easier to work with. The Zoom, Genesys, and RingCentral all use Bandwidth. Now, Bandwidth's white glove customer support touts a 9.8 customer satisfaction rating and is uniquely positioned to help your enterprise migrate with much less frustration and meet regulatory expectations. More than just a team shop, no problem. Bandwidth can help simplify your telecom migration to the cloud with a bring your own carrier solution for RingCentral too, in addition to Microsoft Teams. Check out Bandwidth's Duet for Teams and Duet for RingCentral to see how you can orchestrate your move to the cloud with flexibility and control. Request your proof of concept at bandwidth.com/twit. That's bandwidth.com/twit. And we thank Bandwidth for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for our host roundtable. We love having these because we really get to talk about deep into tech topics that we really care about. And today we're going to get a little bit into SASE. That's right. We all know hybrid is here to stay. People will continue to use their devices for home and for work use. The question is, how can we overcome the challenges that go along with it? And that's where SASE comes in. But I want to hear from the co-hosts here because they are the experts in this area. Brian, Curtis, can you give us a little bit of an overview of what SASE is and maybe, you know, how organizations can take advantage of it?
Kurt, why don't you take this? Because your session started dealing with definitions.
We did. And the first thing to note is SASE is not self-addressed stamped envelope for those out there who are as old as I am. No, it is Secure Access Service Edge. So what does that mean? Well, it is what companies are looking at when they talk about securing their entire application and network infrastructure. And in most cases, there are five, count them, five major components that pretty much everyone agrees should be part of SASE. One is SD-WAN, software-defined wide area networking. Another is zero trust network access. Number three, having a cloud access security broker or CASB. Four, a secure web gateway. And five is firewall as a service. Now you'll note that a bunch of this presumes that you're in the cloud. And that's very true. As a matter of fact, there are some people who say that if you are in an organization that is cloud native, that is already 100% cloud, SASE is much easier to implement. But it's worth noting that no one is saying that SASE is a piece of cake. As a matter of fact, one of the things that we talked about in the session that I was part of on Wednesday is that if your organization is big enough for SASE to be something that would make sense for you, it's big enough to have a very complicated application delivery and networking infrastructure. Now, Brian, I know that you were talking about implementing SASE. So I'm curious, what sorts of things was your panel talking about? And was there any kind of agreement on how companies should be moving forward and how far they should have gotten by now?
Okay, so my big soapbox was to ask people to take a step back. When you start playing anything, when you start talking about a service edge, especially when you start talking about a hybrid environment, you're starting to very much depend upon those back-end internet services like DNS. And I was up on a soapbox saying, people, if you're going to start talking SASE, you had better be planning on or have already done, at the very least, DNSSEC. With all these DNS amplification attacks that are now old hat in the world of hackers, you can actually do some serious, serious damage to a DNS infrastructure, and DNS man-in-the-middle attacks are just all too easy to do when you aren't encrypting the updates between DNS servers. So I started up on my soapbox saying, hey, SASE is not new. SASE has been an iteration, a growth. You know, we started hitting it for things like, 802.1x, when you had Wi-Fi and authenticated ports. Well, that went over like a lead balloon. And even though 802.1x supplicants, the clients, are in just about every modern operating system on Earth, the adoption of 802.1x has been meh. So SASE is an upgrade. It's a iteration, an iterative step towards how we get all these things going, how we get a more secure edge. And Dan Gere did a great keynote a couple years ago during Black Hat, cybersecurity as real politic. And he was basically saying the real edge of the network is the home, because the home office. And now with the pandemic, with so many people not only working at home, but planning on continuing to work from home, SASE or a SASE-like system is going to have to happen in order to start really keeping things from getting out of control. So my last harping here is Google forced all their people to go to multi-factor authentication. And almost, I think they claim they did, but I'm not sure anyone can say 100% of anything. They say the penetration at the edge of Google has stopped completely. So I don't know. We ought to see. Anyway, my suggestion was take a good hard look at joining an organization like InfraGuard, spelled InfraGuard.org. It's a cooperative effort between the private sector and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And while it may sound like Big Brother, it's not. It's an organization amongst your peers where you can have a level of trust, because there is a light background check just to make sure you don't have any outstanding warrants on you, so that there can be a level of trust so that you can share things that are normally for government use only, you know, as far as, you know, attacks that are happening, but also about so that you can go and confidently share your experiences and trade experiences back and forth, which I strongly, strongly suggest. Don't live in isolation. SASE and all these types of technologies all require a lot of knowledge, all require a lot of work. And isn't it great if you don't have to reinvent the wheel?
You know, I think not reinventing the wheel is one of those grand and glorious things. And, you know, one of the things that we do have to understand There are several things that are going to be absolutely required if you're looking at SASE. One of them, and I want to talk about this in a few minutes, is automation. But the other is having cloud providers. I mean, there just is no way to do SASE entirely out of an on-prem data center. It just isn't going to happen. And there have been several conversations around how you go about figuring out which of the various providers is right for you. Lou, I know you have looked at that a bit. What do you think? I mean, are there best practices when it comes to figuring out who you should be working with when it comes to SASE providers?
You know, it's interesting with the adoption of SASE. You know, it obviously combines things like network as a service and CCaaS, security as a service. And so you want to make sure that you are targeting vendors that can have either turnkey solutions there, or they target the specific things that you find important first. Like, for instance, a lot of companies, they prioritize SD-WAN first. And obviously a key component of that is SASE. But it obviously doing that requires a lot of planning. It requires a lot of making sure that you rely on the vendor and that you can trust the vendor that you're working with. And I think that that's one of the biggest points, is making sure that you put together a plan and what you find most important, because a lot of these things need to be prioritized. And then once you start with that prioritization list, you can go find a vendor that has solutions that target those things. I think that's one of the biggest things for me, is that in a lot of there's a lot of them out there. In fact, if you go and search, a lot of companies are either startups or they are companies being acquired out there. I just saw recently that Kaspersky's actually recently purchased Brain Fournette to help build out their tooling there. And of course, Citrix just added a bunch of zero trust and so on to their SASE portfolio. So there's constantly building out solutions. In order to really understand where to start, you have to build out your priority list first. So I think that would be the first thing, is start with a priority list and then go and venture in investigating your vendors and your providers out there. But I'd be curious to hear what you guys' thoughts as well.
Well, one of the things that I think is going to be important is to note that, you know, we're not talking about a SASE provider. That's one of the things that makes it so complicated. There are enough different moving parts in any SASE implementation that you're really talking about putting together a fleet of suppliers. If some of that might include your own staff, that's fine. But in general, you're going to have different providers for the different bits and pieces of a SASE implementation. So one of the big questions you've got to ask is how well the different members of that team are going to play together. It's worth asking them if they're already integrating with one another, and if not, what it's going to take. In other words, are you going to have to foot the bill for the integration effort, or will they consider it part of doing business, do the integration, and then have it available to sell to others? One of the things that is absolutely true about SASE is that it is complicated. This is not one of those things where it is super simple, flip a switch and it's done. And the integration is critical. Brian, I know that over, you know, with all of your decades of work in the interop NOC, that you watched the kind of effort that had to go into integrating and interoperability. So, you know, how big a deal do you think that should be? Do you think that the ability to connect and interoperate should be near the top of your requirements list, or should you go for function and then let the vendors and suppliers worry about the integration?
Well, I think we need to point out one thing. There is no SASE standard. Not yet. And it's for any kind of interoperability, you're going to have some sort of even an ad hoc standard, which doesn't exist. Now, back in episode 465, just a couple of weeks ago, we had Cisco Meraki on, and they're talking about their SASE offering, which sounds great. It definitely starts talking about Cisco's long game that they're playing and how they're integrating all that stuff together, but it's all within the Meraki product line. At Interop, I just, you know, we were highlighting 802.1x, and just getting 802.1x to talk across vendors was a nightmare. The only thing that was gluing us together was a central directory authentication system like Active Directory or LDAP. And so I got a sneaky hunch that Active Directory is probably going to be the glue tying SASE offerings together. And, you know, we'll see. And I'm absolutely sure that while I'm sad to say Lou can't let the cat out of the bag yet, I am absolutely sure that there are SASE toolkits or SASE APIs that either are in Windows 11 or will be in Windows 11 very, very soon. And I'm hoping that will start getting people to start saying, maybe we ought to talk to other SASE vendors. We shall see. Anyway, interoperability is going to happen. It hasn't happened yet. There's no IETF or IEEE working group that I know of. I think they're all in stealth mode at the moment, but I hope they're working hard.
Well, folks, there's a lot more to talk about here when it comes to SASE and providers and how organizations can take advantage of it. But before we get to all that, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And that's Command Line Heroes, an original podcast from Red Hat. Now, Command Line Heroes tells the epic true tales of developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels who are revolutionizing the technology landscape. It offers a unique blend of historical context and current trends shaping the tech landscape. Now, this season tackles one question from every angle. What is a robot? A servant? A factory worker? A prosthetic? A vehicle? Why do we build robots that look like us? And we often ask whether we can trust robots, but can robots trust us? Now, science fiction tells us many stories about robots. In the future, they will serve our every need, or maybe they'll develop a mind of their own and turn against us. Maybe they will be the savior of humanity, or they'll even be our downfall. Well, season 8 of Command Line Heroes covers the robots that are in our midst and the determined dreamers who bring them to life. Now, 8 episodes compare the promise of science fiction to the reality of robots today. Now, I had the opportunity to listen to the first episode, Robot as a Service, and it was so interesting. Now, here's a clip.
While making this season, we discovered a robot reality that's pretty removed from the robots we imagined. And yet, all those misguided ideas about what a robot should be actually shaped what robots are. And no robot fiction shaped things more than the story we told ourselves about robotic servants.
Now, the 1980s promised robotic servants were in reach. Remember the Jetsons? Well, if you look around, we're getting pretty close, but they're not there yet. Now, this effort was a great account from the past and the future. Really great episode. Now, this award-winning podcast is hosted by Saran Yabarak and produced by Red Hat. Now, season 8 is out now. Search for Command Line Heroes on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you listen to your podcasts. We'll also include a link in the show notes. And my thanks to Command Line Heroes for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking about SASE and solutions for SASE, maybe in some vendor providers for those. Now, obviously, we all talked about how the fact that there's no one size fits all here, and the fact that you really have to prioritize where you think you need to start. But there's some other works there too. There's some other advantages to moving to SASE solutions. What do you guys think? Is it the fact that it's a turnkey solution? What's the next thing that's really an advantage of SASE? Curtis, Brian?
Well, I'm going to push back against one thing you said, because I don't think anyone really is claiming that SASE is a turnkey solution. As a matter of fact, when a number of organizations have gone and done surveys, about companies, where they are in SASE, the average length of time that they think that a SASE implementation is going to take is somewhere in the 5 to 7 year range. You know, this is a huge undertaking for most organizations. And it's worth noting that because of all the different moving parts, we're rapidly at a point where human administrators, human managers, human, you know, network administrators, human security analysts can't keep up. And so a piece that really is assumed, it wasn't named in any of the things I talked about, but it has to be assumed, is automation. And that can be some sort of coordinated automation for all of these things. It can be automation that comes in from a side, from a particular standpoint. It can be multiple automation frameworks that are themselves tied together through some sort of integration framework. The thing is, human beings sitting at a desk or series of desks with a bunch of screens up in front of them aren't going to be able to keep up. And so I think, you know, whenever we talk about SASE, you know, I mentioned those five points that pretty much everyone agrees are part of SASE. There are a lot of other things that that companies are putting into their SASE implementation. There's a long list, which includes things like cloud-based security analytics, content delivery networks, DDoS protection, user behavior analytics, cloud-based SIEMs, Wi-Fi hotspot protection, DLP or data loss prevention, web filtering, and the list goes on and on and on because so many pieces can be part of this. So Lou, I am going to come back to you. I know that you, of course, you deal in the realm of software. You know, when you hear the talk about all of these various pieces and parts, how complex do you think the automation framework is going to end up being for an enterprise class SASE deployment?
I mean, think about it. You know, if we just talk about all the moving parts when it comes to software, right? You have software as a service. You have infrastructure as a service. You have, you know, potentially your on-premise data stores. You have, you know, you maybe have multi-cloud environments. Another thing where you're storing data in different clouds or different providers. I think just in general, if you just talk about the environment in general, you can really understand the complexity that goes along with it. And I think that's where, you know, SASE solutions are essentially promising to help with. And I think that, you know, automation can definitely assist in this. You know, like for instance, automatically discovering the interconnectivities, different hybrid clouds. That's a promise of SASE solutions out there. And I think that's an automation that can really, allow you to configure things more quickly. It can also ensure that you're not forgetting things. Another thing is, like, for instance, dynamic overlay on connectivity for, you know, different control planes in the cloud. I think that's another thing that SASE allows you to do. And I think that type of automation is going to get you to where you need to be faster. But that also means there's going to be a lot of complexity behind it. There's going to need to be auto discovery of a lot of different components of your environment. And so the more complex your environment, the more complex the SASE solution needs to be. So I think that there is a lot of advantage to going to some of these solutions. But again, like I said before, your organization has to do the research to make sure it's going to fit your topology.
No question. And I think one of the things I want to touch on before we have to button up today is, remember the name of this, it's Secure Access Service Edge. And for most enterprise users these days, that edge is going to be out there in their home. And that means that we have to find ways to secure the connection from the laptop, desktop, mobile device, whatever it is, sitting out there at the employee home and the enterprise cloud or data center or both. One of the ways that companies are doing this is through software. VPNs are falling out of favor, but there are zero trust network access applications that work. Some companies are sending out secure routers and secure access points to their employees to use to reach the corporate network. Brian, I think you are uniquely situated to talk about this. When you hear about a secure access service edge, you know, do you think, I mean, is this going to require some sort of secure router being dropped to the employees, or can it really be done entirely in software?
I don't know. You know, that's a good question. You know, with the emergence of some of these new, really awesome CPUs, we've got the horsepower to do some interesting things. You know, just like, you know, go back 10 years, used to have hardware accelerators to be able to do encryption on your workstation or server. Well, I think this is all going to be baby steps. In fact, I'm going to propose a title for the show, and it says The Road to Zero Trust. And that's what it's going to be. In fact, one of the people I've been chatting with in Discord under Club Twit was Adam the Phantom. And I was telling him, you know, he's trying to get into the industry, and I suggested, you know, go talk to InfraGuard. But realistically, I think SASE is a goal. I don't think it's a standard yet. I don't think it's something that everybody has. I'm not even sure it's going to be called SASE by the time we finally get it. But the goal is to have zero trust. We want to have something where we can log in. We need to do away with things like passwords. Passwords are going to be the bane of our existence for as long as people keep using passwords. We need to have everybody doing multi-factor authentication. We need to make sure that we give the hackers, the bad guys, a really hard time, make this really, really difficult. And SASE or a SASE-like infrastructure where we have a zero trust edge to go with the zero trust core, I think that's where we're going to need to be. And, you know, like Kurt was saying, it's probably going to be, you know, 5 to 7 years, maybe a little longer. I think it's going to be a combination of a lot of different technologies that we've been slowly building. You know, the Lego bricks have been slowly accumulating that we can build things together. You know, things like I did a huge bake-off on identity management. That was kind of interesting. And then we had huge bake-offs on firewalls, but now the perimeter is dead. What we are doing, though, is we're building blocks that we can build a zero-trust future. And, you know, I don't think it's going to be SASE. I really don't. I think there's going to be a lot of arguments on SASE or SASE-like standard. But I think SASE should be a goal that we all strive towards.
You know, I have to agree with you, Brian, that because it is so complex and because the pieces that go into it are shifting, I think that it's highly likely that what we end up with in the 5 to 7 years that we're talking about it taking to do an implementation could end up being called something else. You know, maybe it'll simply be called, you know, computing by then. It's hard to say. And it's worth remembering that SASE is something that has really been supercharged by the COVID-19 pandemic. 3 years ago, people weren't really talking about it. Why? Because 3 years ago, we hadn't sent virtually all office workers home to work for 18 months. Now that has happened, we know that there are many of those employees who really want to continue working from home, if not all the time, at least most of the time. And what the IT security people have realized is that in a very real sense, securing our enterprise infrastructure, and that's cloud and on-prem and hosted and everything else, means to some extent securing the devices that live out there in the employee homes. That's much more complicated, and that gets into all kinds of issues like privacy. Think back 5 or 6 years to the dawn of mobile device management, when the question was, how much control will we give our employers over the data that's on our phone? The very first iterations of MDM were blunt objects. I mean, they really did come in and say, well, if something happens, we just erase your phone. If you leave the company, we just erase your phone. And oddly enough, people were reluctant to let that be happening. Today, these are much more fine-grained products. And I think that we're going to see that because none of the things that we're talking about are stationary. Every one of the components of SASE that we're talking about is evolving just as SASE itself is evolving. Well, speaking of evolving, our time here has evolved through the conversation right up to the point where we really need to think about buttoning up this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Lou, that sounds like a job for you.
Thank you, Curtis. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. So definitely tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-hosts here, the experts in their field. Starting with Horeo, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, what's going on for you in the coming weeks? Where can people find you?
I'm talking to Adam24 in the chat, and I'm going, I think it's just about time for me to go and harass Apple to see if I can convince them to let me be a beta user of their cache dongle. Because I think a device like that that holds our identity in cryptographic form is going to be one of those building blocks. So I want to get a little more experience with that. That and there's some pretty neat crypto dongles out there now. Anyway, other than that, I'm playing with my precious, the new Ubiquiti router. It is, I will say, upfront beta equipment. So I'm not putting it in production yet, not till it goes full general release. But I will be talking to a lot of the Twyatt listeners out there. And my Twitter handle is ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, and I'd love to talk to you there. Direct message me if you'd like, or just throw it into my thread. Or you're more than welcome to throw me an email. I'm Chebert, spelled Cheebert, at twit.tv. And you can hit all the hosts at twyatt@twit.tv. We'd love to hear from you. You know, your comments help make the show better. And, you know, I think we really need to go and talk some more to you folks because, man, oh, man, you guys had some great ideas during this show. I really want to hear more. See you next week.
Thanks, Chibert. Well, we also have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming weeks and where can people find you and all your great work?
Well, I'm doing a lot of talking in the coming weeks. I was in a rehearsal today for a webinar on gamification that I'm doing on November 17th. That's the same date. I'm speaking in a virtual event hosted by our friends over at Dark Reading. Then on December 8th, I'm doing a conversation around the idea of metrics and measurement in enterprise cybersecurity awareness training with the good folks at Cyber Reason. So there are lots of things coming up. I've got a bunch of research that I'm doing. And in my copious spare time, I'm also getting ready here in Orlando for Maker Faire Orlando, which is coming up in a couple of weeks. It is the largest volunteer-produced Maker Faire in the country, one of the largest volunteer-produced Maker Faires in the world. And we are looking forward to that after not being able to do an in-person event last year. So it's coming back, and there is a ton to do. So all in all, I'm staying plenty busy and happy to be so. But if anyone wants to reach me, please follow me on Twitter. I'm at KG4GWA, and I love to hear from the members of the Twiat Riot.
Thank you, Curtis. Thank you, guys. This show definitely wouldn't be the same without you. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You, the person who drops in each and every week to which to watch and listen to our show to get your enterprise and IT goodness. We want to make it easy for you to listen and catch up on your IT news. So go to your show page, go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the host information, the guest information. Of course, more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. Definitely support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices, on any one of your podcast applications, because we're on all of them, and supporting the show means subscribing. So definitely do that for us. Plus, you may have heard about Club Twit. That's right. It's a members-only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus fee that you can't get anywhere else, and it's over only $7 per month. Now, one of my favorite things, obviously, of Club Twit is that exclusive access to the members-only Discord channel. Some really great, interesting people in there, some great channels, some great topics, some of the really great topics that people talk about. I really love being in there. So definitely join the club and be part of the movement. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit. Now, Club Twit now offers corporate group plans as well. That's right. It's a great way to give your whole team access to our ad-free tech podcasts. Now, the plans start with 5 members at a discounted rate of $6 each per month, and you can add as many seats as you like. And really, this is a great way for your IT department, your developers, your tech teams to stay up to date with access to all of our podcasts. And just like regular memberships, they can join they can see the Twit Plus feed as well as all of our bonus content, and of course the Discord channel as well. So definitely have them check that out, twit.tv/clubtwit. Plus, it's that time of year. That's right, we're putting together the list of the best of episodes, the best of episodes. We want to hear from you and get some of your picks, some of your ideas. So head over right now to twit.tv/best of. Give us your picks there. We definitely want to hear from you and get some of those episodes from you. So definitely check that out. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends and your family members with the gift of Twiat. We talk about some fun tech topics on the show, and we definitely want to hear from you and also have you share Twiat with the rest of your family, because I guarantee they will find it interesting and fun as well. Now, after you subscribe, definitely check out the show live. We do this live at twit.tv every Friday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time. And we want to have you join and watch the show live. So go definitely do that and come see how the pizza's made. Come see the behind the scenes, all the fun stuff that we do here on this show. So definitely check it out and hear all the banter and fun that we do. Plus, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room live as well. IRC.twit.tv. We have a lot of great characters in there each and every week. Loquacious. We have Chickenhead in there. We have everybody. Definitely check that out and be part of the group and be part of the discussion. IRC.twit.tv. Definitely hit me up on twitter.com/LouMM. I've actually talked with a lot of great people this week over there. A lot of great topics, a lot of fun, interesting releases last week on hardware and OSs and software. So definitely come and check that out and maybe even send me a DM for show topics and so on. Definitely check that out on Twitter. Of course, you want to know what I do during my work week at Microsoft. Definitely check that out at developers.microsoft.com/office. There we have the latest and greatest ways you can customize your office experience and make it more productive for you. So definitely check that out, and definitely also check out next week. We're going to be at Ignite. Check that out. We'll be talking about Office Script and all the latest and greatest ways to customize your office experience. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we couldn't do the show without them. So thank you for all their support. We, again, also I want to thank all the engineers and staff at Twit. They They make this show easy for us, and we couldn't do the show without them. Of course, I want to thank Mr. Brian Chi one more time. He's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer. He does all the show bookings and all the show notes for this for the show, and we really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you, Chibert, for all your support. I know it's a very challenging thing to do, and we couldn't do the show without you. Of course, before we sign out, we also have to thank our TD for today. He's Mr. Victor B. Victor, how are you, my friend? How's things going over there in Twit?
Good. It's good to be back in the studio, and I'd just like to say to you guys in person that even though I'm not here in the studio, I love interacting with you guys every week in the back channel and all that stuff. So, since Ant's not here, I'm going to plug twit.tv/hop. This week, he spoke with Jefferson Graham, formerly of the USA Today, about some smartphone tips. And it was very interesting. So
definitely check that out. It's a hands-on photography is one of my favorite shows on Twit. So definitely check that out and see some of the new episodes. Until next time, I'm Loomis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Hey, you don't have to wait till the weekend to get the tech news you need. Join Jason Howell and myself, Micah Sargent, for Tech News Weekly, where we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news.